full range of reasonable results.
Okay.
Or at reasonable effort.
That's fair.
It's quite logical.
I didn't say this was the be all end all. I'm just trying to give you I think beyond the bounds of a point estimate.
I'd like to get started with our second session in the reserve variability track at the spring meeting. The first thing I'd like to do is make a little pitch for some of the continuing educational work we're planning on doing this year. We have a task force on advanced reserving education, and primarily the function of this is to try to fill in the gaps where the CLRS does not fully cover the material or meet the members' needs. And in general, the CLRS is really a great event for reserve actuaries, and they do an excellent job covering the material. There's some people that aren't able to go to CLRS meetings. Other people can only go to one meeting a year and maybe going to spring meetings, which is why we're having this session, which is sort of like a greatest hits of the CLRS. This is the first event that we planned for this year. Secondly, we're working on a limited attendance seminar to be held in late October, probably at O'Hare, somewhere around O'Hare Airport in Chicago. It'll be a day and a half limited attendance seminar, and the idea is it will be hands-on, and we'll start at the beginning and work all the way through. We're also, this is maybe more aspirational than fully planned, but we'd also like to put some material together for the regional affiliates. So we do expect to provide additional education, particularly primarily on this topic of reserve variability, how to deal with it, and how to go from theory to practice, where I think there's still quite a gap. I know I see a lot of people were at the first session. I'll try not to repeat too much. The first session I won't really repeat it, but Rodney and Mark laid out the basic concepts, principles, and issues regarding distributions and ranges, et cetera. What do we book? For our second session, we have an all-star lineup of panelists. We have a man with a green hat, Roger Hain. Roger's got a PhD from the University of California. He's current chairman of the CAS Research and Development Committee, which is really our premier committee, since we're primarily a research and educational organization. That's my personal opinion. Former chairman of KOTOR, Committee on Theory of Risk, and co-chair of the Working Party on Reserve Variability, which is really the focus of this. So we've got the man. In addition, for those that weren't here for the first session, Mark Chaplin has never seen a working party that he didn't like, or he could say no to. He's one of our bigger contributors in the CAS, and right now he's co-chair of the Tail Factor Working Party. If people have questions on tail factors, catch up with Mark. Also, the loss simulation model working party, and he's retiring chairman of the DRM, Dynamic Risk Modeling Committee. And before I turn it over to Roger, since I had nothing to do with this paper, the working party paper on reserve variability, I feel like I can maybe praise it without sounding biased. But I think it's really an outstanding piece of work. I think that, you know, when you look back and reserving papers, there's things like the Berquist-Sherman paper that are sort of, you know, people read and become part of their practice that really have a significant impact. And what the working party did was they did a very thorough summary of the literature, what's been done, and they've also developed a framework for thinking about, discussing, and understanding reserve variability. And I would strongly encourage people that haven't spent time reading it to get a copy, keep it by your bedside, you know, keep one handy, and spend some time reading it. And you know, and if you, when you print it out single-sided, it looks kind of thick, but it's only yay big, and it's in your, if you get hard copies, it's in your fall 95 forum. So at this point, I'll turn it over to Roger.
Tom, after an introduction like that, there's only one thing to say.
Thank you very much.
Anyway, we're going to be kind of looking at who does what on reserve ranges, kind of a current state of the affairs. I'm going to try to take kind of the introductory first bit, and it turns out that I'm going to be repeating quite a bit. I'm going to be repeating some from the first session, so hopefully if you hear it with a different spin, maybe you'll understand it better, or, you know, maybe you'll still throw rocks at me, but that's okay. Anyway, reserve. Start off with that nice word. You know, we all know what a word, we all know what it means. You know, reserve is an accounting term, okay? And it's supposed to be a reasonable estimate, whatever that means, of the unpaid claim costs. You know, that's nice and vague. You know, it just requires something called a reasonable estimate, whatever that means. And also, you notice it says a reasonable estimate of the unpaid claim costs. So what you're trying to pick isn't the average. It's not the mean. It's not the mode. It's not the median. It's what's going to happen. So the only good, you know, the only good reserve is the reserve that happens. And we all know that has a chance that's about parallel to a snowball out here at this time of the year, during the day, in the sun. So, you know, if you want to think about an estimate or a reserve being what is going to happen, the chance of you being wrong is real good, okay? But that's the way you're tested, right? They say, all right, you said the reserve is going to be $20 million. We finally run off this book of business, and it's been $10 million. You cost the company all that time when we could have been writing all that more business on that surplus. Or, you know, the reserve came out to be $50 million. You know, you're wrong again. That's Rodney's target for the folks that were around in the first session. You know, because what people are thinking about is what is going to happen. And that's not what we're thinking about with the reserves. We're kind of thinking about, well, often think about, you know, different things. See, even if we knew everything that was going to be happening, you know, with Mark's comment in the first session, we don't really have any guidance on what to book as a reserve. And to echo what Rodney said, and I swear I didn't catch either Mark's slides from the first session or Rodney's, but echoing what Rodney says, the reserve is really the distribution. That's really the financial impact. And what the accountants are forcing are just a single number. We have to, you know, we have to worry about it. You know, they want to put down a single number, but what that single number has to do is somehow embody this entire range of possibilities. And therein lies the problem. That's why we have all these interesting issues. Why a distribution? Well, future payments are uncertain. We don't know what the future usually we don't know what the future payments are going to be. If we have a book of single paid life, you know, single premium whole life policies, You know, we know for pretty good fact that we're going to get claims on all of them, or almost all of them, assuming that we don't have suicides. And we know what those claims are going to be. And that was, you know, comment that from the other session that, you know, Don was saying that the life guys have already have standards as to what to book. Well, they also have a convenient distribution that they can work with, and, you know, their uncertainty is just coming from basically the economic side, from investment income. Again, you know, the fact that they're ahead of us simply is because, I think, most likely because of the fact that, you know, they have easier distributions to work from than we do. But in any case, problem is that a single number really can't convey the uncertainty that's inherent in the range of possible future payments. If we had a distribution, you know, we could talk about things like the mean, mode, median, probability level, or any other statistic, but accountants insist on a single number embodying all that the reserve means. And then we talk about which of the infinitely many numbers is the best possible to convey that message. So when we were putting together the working party paper, recognizing that, we decided to do what all good actuaries would do with faced with a dilemma. We punted. We decided not to talk about reserves. Okay? This is basically saying, well, we're going to first focus on things that we can deal with, and then we'll worry about this unknowable thing called reserve. And then, but at least when we have ideas of the underlying distributions set down, then we can talk more intelligently about which number that best represents it. So the whole paper, the whole working party paper, focused on a distribution of outcomes under a policy or group of policies for an insurer rather than reserves. So we're going to stay away from the accounting context, at least for most of the discussion, and focus on the distribution, focus on the outcomes, focus on the forecasts. That way we can kind of, you know, move beyond this philosophical discussion, at least temporarily, as to what number to book. So, you know, if I end up falling into the bad terms and using things like reserves, you can slap me around. I'm going to try to talk about distributions of outcomes. And then later on, we'll try to kind of see how maybe that can inform what we book. But that is a heck of a step ahead if we know what the distribution is than right now when we, you know, if we don't have a clue. So it will inform the discussion when we get to it. Okay, how do we get here? You know, why are we even talking about that, this? Well, first of all, the accounting definition is intentionally vague, and it says seems to be. Well, it's more than seems to be. It is very vague. The current CAS statement of principles on reserves, and not the new one that's in draft, but I'm talking about the existing one, talks about things like reasonable estimates and ranges of reasonable estimates. You notice there's no mathematical or statistical provision, in what is meant by reasonable estimates. You know, what's a reasonable estimate? And why is this? Well, we quote Tevye from Fiddler on the Roof, tradition. And really, and you know, how did that tradition happen? Well, if we kind of step back and look back to the Dark Ages, back when the CAS was young, and back before probably anybody in this room was born, there were methods that were developed to try to get handle on the forecast. And now these methods, being in the days before calculators and computers, had to be reasonably easy to use based on numbers that you could put together without a whole lot of pain. So you get these, you know, traditional methods, you know, like the link ratio, development factor, chain ladder, whatever you want to call it, based on triangles that say, well, yeah, you know, if things kind of happen this way, then the ultimate loss is going to be this. And, you know, they give you estimates. They give you these things they call forecasts or estimates. You know, and really, these are methods, again, with what Mark talked about in the last session, methods and models. These are methods. They tell you how to do some calculations, and you come up with numbers. You come up with things at the end called estimates. You know, and really they're not means, modes, middle of the road numbers, most likely expected. They're just kind of estimates. Well, that's okay because we're supposed to estimate what's going to happen. So since the chance of any number happening is virtually nil, then any estimate is as good as any other, right? Well, maybe, maybe not. But there's no way to quantify that, at least in the individual methods. So our foreparents, back in the old days, realized this. They realized when they looked at a book of autophysical damage data, or wagon physical damage data, maybe, that, okay, sorry, just small attempt at levity, not as good as Rodney. Okay. They realized that it was easier to get hands around what the ultimates are going to be on that than it is for, say, a book of workers' comp or employers' liability, which has, you know, a lot more uncertainty. And they knew that in their guts. And again, the comment in the last session that Rodney made, you know, there's some instinct there. Even without any statistical background, you can get kind of a gut feel. And the way our foreparents did it, they threw a lot of methods at the problem. And, you know, if the methods bunched up pretty well, then they had a pretty good feeling that, yeah, the numbers are going to be pretty tight. You know, if they threw a bunch of methods at the data and they gave a bunch of wildly different results, then you get a kind of a feel, maybe these things are a little bit more uncertain. So over time, the traditional actuarial approaches that a lot of us learned coming through the trenches were based on these, you know, kind of general judgments without any specific statistical background. And then, you know, because of that, you needed to come up with, well, since reasonable was undefined, you know, and the fact that if you've got kind of a noisy type line of business, you know, maybe actuaries can come up with pretty widely different answers, none of which are unreasonable. Whereas if you've got a pretty tight line of business like auto physical damage, you know, reasonable actuaries are going to be pretty doggone close. So now let's try to get our arms around these things without talking about statistics, because we don't have them in our methods yet. And we need to somehow get a description of what these things mean. And so our statements of principles come up with these ideas of ranges of reasonable results and ranges of reasonable estimates. You know, and here again, it's still important to discuss uncertainty. Quantify how uncertain an estimate is. And these are really required because we don't have any statistical basis or statistical background in our traditional methods. But again, you notice that things are still, you know, there's no statistics in the definitions. We still have very, very soft definitions. And, you know, it's like beauty is in the eye of the beholder, reasonable is in the eye of the reviewer. And, you know, that doesn't really give us a whole lot of, you know, it gives us some kind of general guidelines, but not much. But, well, let's just kind of look into the future and think about what might be happening, you know, later, maybe 10, 20 years from now. A more reasoned approach, and assume that a reserve still needs to be a single number, and boy, I'd love to see it somehow replaced in the statement by an actual distribution. And then let's just say that, assuming we have a distribution, we define a reasonable estimate or a reasonable reserve or a reasonable whatever as a particular statistic on that distribution. Okay. And let's say we can all agree on it. I personally like Rodney Krebs's least pain function that he at least referenced in the last session. It makes a whole lot of sense. It doesn't add. Well, who cares? Because risk really doesn't add. You know, if you have anything that's not completely correlated, the law of large numbers says that you have less risk as you combine them. So why should an estimate based on risk add, well, I mean, this is a discussion that Mark and I can have, because I think that was at least one benefit of the mean when combining non-correlated distributions. I'm saying, well, that's so. It's a benefit. You know, the mean adds. Big deal. But I kind of like Rodney's least pain function for a lot of reasons. But, you know, let's not get hung up on that. We could talk about if, you know, let's just assume we can assume some statistic, some single number is the best representative. You know, whether it's the least pain, it's the mean, the mode, the median, I don't care. But let's just say that we make that decision. Then maybe we can talk about ranges of reasonable estimates and distributions of outcomes in a statistical sense and see how they differ. Let's talk about a few terms first. Again, this is going to be reflecting a little bit on the last session. We do know that the ultimate future payments on insurance claims are generally unknown, but that at least theoretically, for any given future amount, there's a probability that those payments are not going to exceed that amount. Those are the percentiles. Generally, we're going to have to estimate those probabilities. And, you know, I can see how in the future this could involve a number of steps. But now let's just take a very simple example. And again, this is quite akin to Mark's die roll example earlier, except that I didn't add the $10 million to everything. I'm going to just assume that I write a policy on January 1st, 2006. And when I write the policy, I take a single die. It's totally fair, so the chance of 1 through 6 is, you know, all 1/6 of it. Roll it and cover it up and not look at it. Then at the end of the year, I'm going to pay a claim. Well, at the end of the year, I need to set the reserve. January 1st, 2007, I'm going to settle the claim for $1 million times however many spots are showing up on that die. I'm going to assume that I don't have an earthquake and, you know, the die doesn't move or anything. So, but in any case, let's see, some accounting, so what we'll have is at the end of the year, we have an equal chance of paying $1, 2, 3, 4, 5, or 6 million. So some accounting guidance says, well, book the low end of the range, $1 million. Some will say, you know, pick the midpoint, $3.5 million. But, you know, whatever it is, you know, we know that the mean and the median of that distribution is $3.5 million. There is no mode. Remember, the mode is the most likely, and all the points are equally likely, so there is no mode. What would you book as a reserve? That's a good question. Let's go for the audience. $3.5 million. Okay, I have $3.5 million. Do I hear? No. How many would book the mean at 3.5? Okay, I'd say 30-40%. Yes?
I would say there is a chance of 17%, 1 out of 6, that it will exceed 5 billion.
Okay. So you set?
That's what I would say. I would say there's a chance of.
Right, well, but where would you set the reserve?
You have to book a single number.
It depends on who is setting the reserve.
You're setting the reserve.
You.
You're setting the reserve personally.
I would probably set it at 4.
Okay, 4. Right, but you know, but now, but we could talk about. See, the nice part about this. Well, first of all, it's a rigged game because we know everything. No, but we do know everything. We can talk about it. Now, notice what we were saying before. What we want the reserve to be is an estimate of what's going to happen. Guess what? 30% of you were automatically wrong because there ain't no way you can get $3.5 million for the reserves. Okay? Because if the name of the game is to book what will happen, there's only one right answer. You got 1/6 chance of picking it, and I don't know which one it's going to be. So you got 5/6 chance of being wrong. Picking the mean, you got 100% chance of being, quote, wrong. So, you know, this whole idea of trying to pick the number that's going to happen really doesn't make a whole lot of sense. The only reason why it makes sense is that you can look back and say, aha, that's what happened. So, you know, if that die came up to be a 5 and I had to pay $5 million, what does that mean? Well, that just means bad stuff happens. Or if, you know, the die came up 2 and I only had to pay $2 million, good stuff happens. Does that mean I don't know anything about the distribution? No. It just means that I have some inherent uncertainty that I can't get around. So now, you know, maybe this idea of range of the reasonable estimates in that versus the potential outcome. Once you start thinking about that, you know, there's some dichotomy. You know, if you're trying to pick the point on the distribution that's going to happen, you got a snowball's chance. If you're trying to pick some statistic, you probably have a better chance. Here, if we all agreed that the right number to book, and again, we don't have any guidance, but if we all agreed that the right number to book was the mean, we'd have it known with 100% certainty. There'd be absolutely no uncertainty in the reserve, even though there's a ton of uncertainty in the outcome. This is something that's really important to bear in mind when you're thinking about reserve variability and trying to quantify this. You've got to be able to at least keep in straight in your mind, the sources of uncertainty. Let's take another example, and it's almost as simple. Here now, instead of having a fair die, I'm going to have the same game, but instead of having a fair die, I'm going to have it weighted toward the ends. So 1 and 6 have an equal probability of 1-4, so there's a 50-50 chance you're going to get out to the extreme. There's roughly a 1/3 chance that you're kind of in the, either 2 or 5, and there's only a 1/6 chance that you're either 3 or 4. So it's really, it's really a heavy bimodal distribution. Again, the mean and the median are 3.5. It has no mode, it's bimodal, so the most likely is either 1 million or 6 million. Now, my mean is the same here. What do I pick for the reserve? How many want to pick the mean again? Yeah, it's more complicated. I think a lot of us would probably, well, if we were, had a company with some finite surplus less than $6 million, or, maybe slightly more than $6 million, we'd probably pick closer to the higher end just because, it's more prudent to do that. But there's nothing in the rules that says, nothing in the way the rules of the game are set up that says we should pick any particular number, much less the mean. Now, again, I would say that I would look at Rodney's least pain function. Depending on how it's set up, it'd probably be something bigger than 3.5, but it makes a whole lot more logical sense. But I'm just going to leave that from now. But again, if only one statistic is reasonable, then the range of reasonable estimates is a single point. Again, if we sat and determined, hey, the mean is the right number, if that was the rule of the game, we only got one mean. Again, the whole process here is completely known. So again, these are things that you need to keep in mind when you're starting to deal with issues of uncertainty. So, typically what we'll do, again, stepping forward into the future, potentially, when we do this estimation, we'll define one or more models of the future payment process. Estimate the parameters underlying those models, assess the volatility of the process underlying under the assumptions that the particular models and parameters are correct, and then aggregate all the uncertainty from all these steps to get a whole view of the distribution of possible outcomes. And this kind of parallels, and this is a place where Mark and I have had some interesting discussions. I have a built-in bias to the old traditional ways that you look at a lot of different things and then try to combine them. I think Mark's has often argued that a better approach would be to look at a family of models and pick the best one, but I kind of keep saying, well, what if that whole family isn't right but another family is? So, I tend to like I like what our four parents have done. I like the fact that they do look at a lot of different models that have methods that have a lot of different underlying assumptions and use that to try to get a sense of what's happening. So in this context, we'll have an aggregate distribution, which would be the range of potential outcomes. A range of reasonable results is not this range of outcomes. Here's a place where I completely agree with what Mark said in the first session. There is a difference between the range of reasonable estimates and the range of potential outcomes. You may inform a reasonable estimate from by the range of outcomes, but you could still get a range. You know, even if I said that a reasonable estimate is the mean, I can still get a range of reasonable estimates given different assessments of, you know, given different models on how to get to that mean. So let's take a look at throwing in parameter uncertainty into all of this. And again, I'm following the definitions that that were presented in the last session, process uncertainty being the underlying uncertainty in the process, even if you knew everything was correct. In the die example, we only had process uncertainty because we knew all the model. We knew the whole process involved. Parameter uncertainty says, okay, we've got, we know what the model kind of looks like, but there's some parameters that we don't know about. And that would be a situation where, you know, the die example, except that I'm not sure that the die is loaded, you know, it's a fair die. So I have some uncertainty about the particular probabilities, but I still have a die example. And again, model uncertainty could say that the whole process doesn't look like a die, but it looks like a random pick from a normal distribution. So I have a whole different model. And, you know, I'm not sure which of these models we're looking at. But let's take a look at trying to separate this range of reasonable estimates idea from the range of outcomes. Let's look at a very simple example. And this, believe it or not, is very simple. And I don't think I'm even going to get into any integrals on this one. But let's assume that I have a process that gives me a log normal distribution at the end. I know what the variance of that, or the sigma squared parameter of that log normal is, but I don't know what the mean is. But I do know, or the first parameter, and I'm going to parameterize the log normal using the mean and the variance of the transform normal. So the m parameter is unknown, the first parameter, where the second parameter, the variance of the transform distribution, is known. But I do know that the unknown mean, m parameter, has a normal distribution with mean mu and variance tau squared. Okay, so think of it. It's a log normal distribution with effectively the average of the log normal unknown, but the distribution of the average is known. Okay, I can put both of those things together. It turns out that if I do, the mean, let's say that we're assuming that the mean is a reasonable estimate, then the mean has a log normal distribution, just turns out, with parameters mu plus sigma squared over 2 and tau squared. So the CV of the mean, the coefficient of variation, which is the standard deviation divided by the mean, is either tau squared minus 1. All right? But now, that would then be my distribution of reasonable estimates. If I assume that the mean is a reasonable estimate, this gives me the distribution of reasonable estimates. Now, if I step back and I say, no, I want the distribution of outcomes, what does that look like? Well, I can do the arithmetic or the calculus on this one, and it turns out that the total outcomes, the posterior distribution, is again log normal, but this time the parameters are mu and sigma squared plus tau squared. Now, if you look at those two distributions, the expected reasonable estimate and the distribution of outcomes, and you calculate the expected value of either of those, you come up with the same answer. But in any case, for the second one, the distribution of outcomes is log normal, but it has a bigger CV. It's coefficient of variation. The degree of spread is now e to the sigma squared plus tau squared minus 1, or the square of the CV. So, you know, which is exactly what you think would happen. If you think of, you know, the reasonable estimates as one of the, you know, the distribution of a statistic under parameter uncertainty, then you end up getting a narrower range than the entire distribution of outcomes. So this is a kind of a way to think of, or a way And I'm just kind of presenting it right now. I'm not saying it's the way. But it's a way to think of the difference between a range of reasonable outcomes or a range of reasonable estimates and a range of outcomes. Because, again, the range of outcomes is the whole thing, the whole distribution. And really, you know, when you're talking about reserve, you know, these reasonable estimates, you're not talking about the whole distribution, but you're talking about kind of how good your estimate of a particular statistic is out of that distribution, not the whole thing. So, you know, we can, I'll move through this pretty quickly. You know, we can carry this through pretty nicely with a kind of a Bayesian approach. You know, let's say that we can, that we have several different methods or several different, you know, parameterizations on the same model. We could then take a look at all these various distributions and, so we could look at the distribution of outcomes under each of the various models. And then we could weight the chances, you know, if we think of each model as a state of the world, we could weight the various models depending on an assessment of how likely we think that state of the world is. This is all real Bayesian, guys. Then, as information evolves, the models that are closer to the state of the world that is emerging end up getting reweighted more heavily, whereas those that are far away get weighted less. So, yeah, I mean, one way to start off is to simply, you know, let's take a look at a simple an example. And in this case, we're going to have three possible states of the world. We either have a fair die, and again, I'm going to use my die example because, you know, the numbers are pretty easy to work out. First state of the world is an even fair die. Second state of the world is a die that's weighted more heavily toward the sixth side. The third state of the world is a die more heavily weighted toward the first side. Now, it turns out that the overall, the distribution of outcomes, it will end up being, if we go back here, the distribution of outcomes for the whole, you know, assuming that each die is equally likely, then it turns out that the posterior distribution is simply 1/6 all the way across, so the distribution of outcomes is equal probability. It's our first die example. But the expected values, or the, quote, range of reasonable results, or reasonable estimates, is 2.67, 3.5, or 4.33, depending on which state of the world is the correct state of the world. Okay. Now, again, if you set your reserve at the average, it's within 0.83 100% of the time. So, you know, the confidence interval is quite wide. There's a 1/3 chance that, the confidence interval is between 2.67 and 4.33. I mean, that would be the 100% confidence interval. So you could talk about that. You could talk about your ranges that way. Now, let's assume that we do this and again roll a die, and we see now that the die comes up as 2. Okay, what does that tell us about how good our distributions are? Well, Bayes' theorem says that, you know, you can reweight these things simply proportional to the likelihood of the data coming up given the model and then your prior distributions of the model. So I can effectively, if I see a roll of 2, that tells me that there's probably more of a chance that I'm working on the third die that's more heavily weighted toward the low end than I am on the other 2. So maybe I should change my reweighting with that additional information. So I can do that. I'll get a new distribution with a third weight for being a distribution 1. See, you can see that giving a 2 didn't really change the weight I'm giving to distribution 1, but it does give a lot more weight to distribution 3, which is weighted toward the bottom end, and gives a lot less weight to distribution 2, which is weighted toward the top end. So this is my new distribution. I'll get a mean of 3.3 with a distribution of means of 2.67, 3.5, and 4.33, but with slightly different probabilities, with a 48% chance, 33, and a 19. Now, if we come up with another roll and came up one, then we're going to give a lot more weight to the third distribution, because that's starting to feel like it's probably more likely to happen. So the final distribution gets weighted more heavily with a mean of 3, with more weight given to a 2.67 chance of a mean, and much less for the 4.33. And if we observed a string of like 3, 4, 3, 4, that really gives us no real information, so we're basically back to where we started from. But you can do this with a set of models with triangles, right? Because what you can do, a good model is going to give you a forecast for the next diagonal. So what you can do for your Bayesian is, you know, take the set of models you used last year, see what the new diagonal is, and see what the chance of getting that diagonal is given the various models, and use that to reweight the models going forward. So it's kind of a way that you could use the statistics and the actual data to trim your models over time. In any case, timing is everything. Public seem to want certainty on their payments. And I don't know about the folks out here, but most of the time that I've tried to present what I would think are reasonable estimates of the ranges of outcomes and uncertainty, people just kind of look at me cross-eyed and say, my God, how can you, that's way too wide. But unfortunately, in my opinion, what we're dealing with is very uncertain. So the true ranges really are wide, and they don't want to hear that. But anyway, it's virtually certain that our payments will differ. Quantifying the distribution will inform discussion in any case. Make sure that you keep process, parameter, and model specification uncertainty in mind. Models, and here's the big thing, models contain much more information than methods. Try to use them as much as you can. But people complain they're complicated and they take a lot of work. Okay, fine. But they give you a hell of a lot more back. And also, ranges of reasonable estimates are different than ranges of possible outcomes. Thank you. And I think I'll hold off questions, let Mark finish up, and then we'll take questions at the end.
All right. Oh, it's great being the last presenter of the day in a place like Puerto Rico. At least you got a good crowd here. Thank you for staying around. This session is, again, it's in a lot of ways a follow-on to the earlier session. We're going to talk about models and methods. So I apologize to those of you who endured this earlier, but I wanted to cover a little bit of ground that we had earlier in case some people were coming in new. And I want to talk about types of models, but I want to do this a little bit differently than I did in the earlier session. I want to give you a glimpse of the way we categorize the models in the reserve variability paper. Talk about some sources of uncertainty, and the key here is what's essentially section 3 of that paper, talking about model evaluation and selection, really getting at the question that we had at the end of the last session. And here's where I'll get into the sort of my differences from what Roger just alluded to, although I don't think we're as far apart as he may have led you to believe. Just as a refresher, and as maybe new for some people who weren't here earlier, in the paper we define a method as a recipe or an algorithm. Really, essentially, the key thing here is that it's a way of getting at a point estimate. Chain ladder, Bourne to Ferguson are common examples of this. Contrast that to a model, which is more sophisticated. It's more of a statistical process and assumptions around that, almost always, leading to parameters that need to be estimated. And then these are stochastic, essentially. They give you the distribution of the possible outcomes. In the paper, rather than the four sort of vague groups I gave you earlier, we had a little bit different breakdown. We started by talking about the fact that there are mostly triangle-based methods in most of the literature you see. We did recognize that there are some newer papers that talk about individual claim models, which are quite interesting. We didn't really go into a lot of detail about the individual claim models, but most of the categorization, God, it's late in the day, are on triangle-based models and sort of ways of looking at those and ways of distinguishing the different types of models that we summarize in the paper with a common set of terminology and a common set of formulas. And within there, we identified single triangle models versus multiple triangle models, conditional versus unconditional, parametric versus non-parametric, diagonal term, no diagonal term, fixed and variable parameters. I won't go into detail here. Those are all explained in excruciating detail in the paper. Just wanted to give you a different view for the people who were here earlier of there's really a lot more to the types of models out there than we maybe led you believe earlier today. We've seen this a couple of times, talking about process risk, parameter risk, model risk. Process risk is, again, just the random nature of the outcomes. We don't know exactly what's going to happen. In Roger's example, there was process risk, but there was absolutely zero parameter or model risk. We knew exactly what the model was. We knew exactly what the parameters were. We didn't have to guess. It's not the case in our world, which is we have parameter risk. We're trying to, even if we knew the distribution, even if we knew with certainty what distribution our claims were coming from, we'd still have uncertainty of the parameters we were using to estimate the model from. And then the fact is we don't really know what any model is actually correct or not. We're approximating things in every model that we do. We're trying to replicate the statistical features of the data itself with any model, but there's no guarantee that any one of them is really the right one, or that they may be incomplete. The key question, though, as we talked about earlier, is, well, how do you actually go about evaluating all these different models? You've got a variety of things here. What is the process you can go through? Roger's approach is basically credibility weight these things together, right? Essentially, and I'll give Roger a chance to refute what I'm saying, or if I screw it up, too bad. But the approach that I want to describe here is actually fairly similar in the sense that we're trying to distinguish between them, but we're not doing it with saying, well, this one I'm going to give X percent weight and that one Y percent weight. I'm going to look at the statistics and say, well, how do I get to the one that's really the best model? We have these points. As I went through earlier, I had a little bit different numbers here, but how do we pick which one of these is the right one or which one gives us the best answer? Well, what if they were all distributions instead of point estimates? Now how do we pick which one of these is right? Right? Sort of a fundamental question we have to ask ourselves. And again, Roger's approach, if I understand it correctly, is to say, well, some of these have better statistical properties maybe, or we want to weight these together somehow. I'm not sure how he gets at the probabilities other than guess, but my process now in this paper is to do a little bit different. We're going to go back to some fundamental questions, I think, related to this process. Those fundamental questions are, first of all, how well does the model that you're looking at, how well does it measure and reflect the uncertainty inherent in the data? Are you capturing the uncertainty that's in the data? In the die example, are you capturing the fact that there's a 1 in 6 chance of all these different outcomes, or are you just doing something else that's not quite right, or are you assuming it's a flip of a coin and not a die? Right? Are you capturing that uncertainty, the variability, right? And then does the model do a good job of capturing and replicating any other statistical features you find in the data? Right? Two fundamental questions that are going to try to help us answer which of these models is best. Modeling question for you. Is the goal here to minimize the range or uncertainty that results from the model? Think about that one for a second. A lot of people say, well, we like to see a nice narrow range. Well, that might be right, but I don't think that's quite capturing the question yet. I don't think the goal is really to minimize the process uncertainty, right? You don't want to minimize the fact that it could be a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, or 6. The process uncertainty is zero in that example. You want to find a model that has the best statistical model is one that will minimize parameter and model uncertainty, but capture the process uncertainty, right? I had a great example here. I went into to talk to a reinsurance actuary several years ago. I talked to him about some modeling differences, and asked me to do some modeling for him, sort of on the fly. And he gave me this reinsurance data that was just about as ugly as you could get. And so I modeled it, and it actually the process the parameter. Errors weren't all that bad. It actually was a pretty good fit, but the process variance of this stuff looked like terrible, you know, and it was just ugly reinsurance data. And his reaction to that was, well, I can't show that to my CEO. That's just unrealistic. I'm like, well, wait a minute. We're not talking about the uncertainty of the range that you want to pick for the mean. We're talking about the process uncertainty of this data. This is nasty stuff. Why aren't you telling this to your CEO? You need just, it was just a completely different mindset in terms of the range of the mean or whatever we're trying to get to and the process uncertainty that's driving that thing to begin with. You don't want to lose the process uncertainty in what you're doing. You want to capture that. Right? The goal is to find models that will minimize parameter and model uncertainty. You're trying to get to the best model you can find. So coming back to this graph, the process, instead of saying let's credibility weight these together, is saying, okay, let's look at the statistical properties of these different models that generated these distributions without even really even looking at the distributions themselves, but looking at whether they're doing a good job of capturing the data, capturing the features in the data, replicating the process, and eliminate some. What if we decide that one really doesn't do a good job for whatever reason? It's not capturing something that we can seize in the data, so we throw that one out. Right? And we'll look at another one. We'll say, well, that one didn't really do a good job because of something else. Right, and we go through a process, really, of finding the model or models. I'm not saying that we'd necessarily find one model, right, or that this would be only one family of models. I'll correct what I think Roger said earlier. This could be different families of models, different types of things. As you look at the data, you may get into a model with a diagonal term. You may not. I mean, that's a different family altogether, right? You may get into a variety of things, but the process you want to go through is to try to figure out which model is replicating what you find, and you may end up with this one as an example. But that's the goal. So how do we get there? Within the paper, we describe three general sort of areas to sort of think about when you're evaluating the models and the outcomes. The first one is model selection criteria. This is sort of basic, you know, how does the model perform? Is it just before you even look at it? I mean, is it doing what you really think the data is going to be doing? Reasonability checks on the output. Is the output reasonable in the situations that you want to model? And then goodness of fit and prediction error tests. Now we're really getting into the more statistical aspects of really, all right, how can we really distinguish between the different models? So let's start with the model selection criteria. In total, we have about 19 criterion that we came up with, and we grouped them in these different groups. The first one is really fairly straightforward. I mean, it's what are the aims of the analysis? If we're trying to produce a distribution, then we need models. If we're trying to produce point estimates, methods are fine, full stop, right? I mean, you need to ask yourself the question, first of all, what is it you're trying to accomplish? Right, is it an interim review that you only need an estimate? Is it really a full-blown, we need distributions because management really needs this because we need to figure out risk-based capital? I mean, it's a different, you need to sort of set the stage to begin with. That's pretty no-brainer, I think, but we thought it was important to put in there. Data availability. And what data do you have? I mean, that may limit some of the model choices you have. Right? If you don't have ground-up loss data in claim detail, you can't use one of those individual claim models. You have to use a triangle model, or maybe you only have policy year data, or maybe, you know, basically, you know, it's something that we're trained to think about right off the bat. So these are really sort of, again, stepping into the process, fairly straightforward. Thinking about the data that you have, now you want to start thinking about, well, are the different models that I want to consider, or have these procedures been validated against historical data? Do they make sense? they've been tested so that people can say, if there are certain things that I find in the data as I go through, well, this model doesn't do a good job of capturing that, or does it? Right? Some of these are sort. This one in particular is more of a cyclical kind of question. You may have a sort of a group of models you're going to pick from to start with, and that may be a fairly wide range. But as you start learning more and more about the data, coming back to this question, you know, may be very useful, where you say, well, now I found something in the data that I can see that this model isn't going to work. I need to go to a different family or whatever. Criterion 4, again, it's sort of a practical one. Cost-benefit considerations. Can this be performed with widely used software? Is there a lot of analyst time involved, computer time? How difficult is it going to be for you to describe this to senior staff, junior staff, regulators, auditors? If you're not comfortable describing a bootstrapping model, it's kind of hard for you to jump in and start using it without, you know, without the comfort level that you need to say, well, this is why I got what I got, and I can feel comfortable with that. I can explain it to people. I understand that. And that's really a good part of the reason why we're doing this session tomorrow as well, help people start that process. The next group of checks, criteria, is what we've called model reasonability checks. Now, these are things that you sort of just step back from the results now after you run a model and look at them and say, does it really make sense what I'm seeing? I mean, is it giving me something goofy that maybe is pointing to a problem with the model? The first one is, these first two actually sort of go hand in hand, coefficient of variation by year, and that's on a percent scale, it's the standard error divided by the mean, right? So it should be the largest, so percentage-wise, for the oldest accident years and getting smaller as you go forward. On a dollar scale, the standard error should be the smallest for the older years and getting larger generally as you move forward. If you think about it, that's pretty much, you know, basic statistics. If you think you can think of some examples, maybe the 1995 reserve is 100 with a standard error of 100, right? Small dollar, 100% standard correlation coefficient. Maybe the 2005 number is 3,000 with a standard error of 300, right? The numbers got bigger, the percentage got much smaller, right? The most current number really has several years to go, so it's actually, you get the effect of covariance there, essentially. It's one way of thinking about it. Right, so just basic things. So, but it quite often, when you see models run, Mac model bootstrapping sometimes does this, you'll see it start going down for a while, and then the last 3 or 4 years it starts going up dramatically again. That's actually pointing to something in the model that you need to be worried about. Right? There's something going on in there that may be driving that you want to investigate. The overall coefficient of variation should be smaller for all years combined than in any individual year. And the overall standard error, again, dollar scale, percent scale, should be larger for all years combined than any individual year. Sometimes you find funny answers where these aren't the case. Right? On a percentage basis, total all years combined should be smaller than any individual year generally. And you know, it's not that you have to, these are hard and fast rules. It's, you know, if you see some pattern that's telling you, there's throwing up a red flag, then you should investigate it. But you're going to see randomness there. And then on a dollar scale, it should be larger. Common sense things as well, correlation of standard error and coefficient of variation. For all lines of business combined, you'd expect them to be correlated to some degree, right? So if you're developing a model where you're correlating to get an aggregate result for the company and comparing that to the individual lines of business, the correlated standard error should be smaller than the individual sums. Again, it's just the effect of covariance, right? Correlation. Another reasonability check here is the loss development pattern. Some of the models that we're describing in here, incremental models especially, a lot of people say, "Well, I'm not comfortable with it because I don't see a loss development factor in there." Well, you can take the model results after the fact and go back and say, okay, well, what would the loss development pattern look like in this model if I was to try to generate that, to say if that makes sense to you? Are you comfortable with it? Or is it going crazy and you would never believe that if you were doing, you know, your standard analysis that you've grown up using, right? It's just another real reality check to going back and saying, okay, does this model really give me results that are plausible? Criteria 11, consistency of simulated data with actual data. I actually alluded to this in the earlier session where we're talking about simulation models, and if you use link ratios in simulation to produce a simulation, you quite often get results that in simulated data sets that don't look at all like what you'd see in real life. So this is mostly something that we put in there to make sure people understood that and didn't sort of just say, well, we're just going to use it without thinking about it too much. So hopefully that works. And in fact, I guess I could put a quick plug in for one of our working parties that Bob Baer co-chairs with me on the loss simulation model. One of the things we're trying to do actually is create simulated data from the ground up that has nothing to do with link ratios or any model that you see. We're trying to create data that people can use for testing purposes for all these different kinds of models that has nothing to do with a model that you would normally use. We'll see how well we do in 6 months or so when we get there. One of the reasonability check, model completeness and consistency. Is it possible that other data elements or knowledge can be integrated in there? Is there something missing that you don't have in your model yet? In your investigations, did you find some statistical thing in the data that leads you to believe you need a different model? The last area I think is probably the most interesting. Validity of the link ratios. This test is essentially referring to Gary Venter's paper that was discussed or mentioned at least in the earlier session. He wrote a paper a couple of years ago testing age-to-age assumptions of age-to-age factors. I think that's the right title. Very interesting paper. And I can show you the paper graphically fairly easily. Let's say that these are your link ratios for losses at age 12 versus losses at age 24. Very simple graph. And the basic premise of the paper, and it's shown, is that an average link ratio, a volume-weighted average link ratio, is an average regression through these points. Okay, essentially this line. If you were to calculate an average link ratio of these points, the average regression line going through there is exactly what you'd figure out. Okay. Gary's test essentially says, well, let's test to see if this actually should have an intercept or not. What if that was a better fit? If that's a better fit, what that's telling you is link ratios aren't predicting as well as you had hoped. Right? It's a very, very simple test to do. I'm not sure how many people actually use this test, but it's out there. And I don't know what the answer is in terms of, well, if you were called in into court on defending your reserve analysis and you use all link ratio methods and somebody started showing you graphs like this, how would you defend it? I don't know. Part of the answer, actually, is that, interestingly enough, this in some ways points to the Borneo-Ferguson method. I think these guys were way ahead of their time. Essentially, by adding an intercept, you're creating a weighted average in some ways, you know, with a constant value. That's essentially what Borneo-Ferguson's doing, right? So we were ahead of our time in that one, at least. Standardization of residuals. This is a pretty basic and a pretty key thing to look at. Essentially, the residuals are the differences between the actual values and what your model would have predicted the values would have been, right? And look at a graph of that. Here's a graph of a simple model of the residuals predicted against the predicted. Just by visually looking at that, can you tell whether that's a good model fit or not? Anybody would think that that's a great model fit? That's a standard link ratio model, right? How about this one? A lot better, isn't it? I mean, just the difference between those two. It's not rocket science here. It's just visually, if we're assuming, like in the MAC method, normality of the outliers, right? Are these random? And is there any pattern in there? If there is, then there's something else going on that you need to be worried about, right? very much related to the last criteria is looking at these residuals in a couple of different ways, checking against accident development and calendar period development. So using this particular one, we actually, with the exact same data, we can look at it across the development periods, right? How good are we doing capturing the development year movements along there? How good are we at capturing the accident year levels? How good are we doing at capturing the payment years along the diagonal and in total? So this is the exact same set of residuals, just looked at four different ways, right? Additional ways at helping you get at, well, if I had shown you this stuff with the earlier graph with it would look so bad, you'd have seen right away where it was coming from, which of these dimensions, right? Where you need to start working on it, right? Which one was contributing the problems, right? Again, a fairly straight thing. The other thing that was in there was a discussion of heteroscedasticity and outliers. There are statistical tests. I don't think I have any graphs on here to show you outliers. But outliers are essentially if the first and the third quartile make up the inner quartile range. And then if you just look at 150% of that or 300% depending on your tolerance, anything outside of that would be considered an outlier. And the question is of whether you want to throw it out of the model or not. Will that help the fit? If there's a lot of them, then there's probably something else going on. Usually when you see a lot of outliers like that in that kind of a test, what's going on is there's probably heteroscedasticity in the model. And that's a big fancy word for simply means that there's different variability at different parts of the model. Most models like MAC and bootstrapping assume that the distribution is the same across all the years, right? Even in this particular one, you can sort of see that very first year is really wide, and then they start getting smaller and smaller, and then they start getting wider again, right? Just visually, you can see that. In fact, usually you sort of see corridors where there's fairly narrow, and then they get wider, and they get narrower. You know, you can see fairly interesting patterns there. It's something that you'd probably want to adjust for, right? Something that would help you say, okay, there's something else going on here that I need to deal with in the model. Most of those are fairly basic so far, and now we can also talk about some prediction error and out-of-sample data. One way of doing this would be to, if you had ability to do this, this one's a bit more sophisticated, test some of the accuracy of your predictions by taking some of the data out, modeling it with a random sample of the data and seeing how it did predicting the rest of it. Right? Kind of sophisticated, but useful potentially. So a number of goodness of fit measures that we identified in there. The typical one that you're probably most all familiar with is R-squared. So that's goodness of fit statistic. Unfortunately, for R-squared is one that can be easily fooled. You can get a very high R-squared, and the fit can be terrible. So we really haven't identified any one particular measure that's universally great. What we've tried to do is say, well, you should be using a lot of them. You're using several different ones that will probably be good in different situations. Just as some of the squared errors, Akiki information criteria, Bayesian information criteria, and there are some other ones. And I'm not going to put the formulas up here, so don't worry about it. One caveat I will mention, though, is that some of these measures, when you get down to this level, are good for distinguishing the fit of a model within a family, but they're not as useful when you say, well, what's the AIC for one family compared to another? You may be getting completely different types of modeling things going on. So you got to be kind of careful when you do that. Those things are generally for fine-tuning the model and the parameterization of the model within a family, generally. Okay? But they're very useful. You can really tell, you know, if your model's improving or not. One of the things we felt was useful putting in here was Occam's razor, principle of parsimony, which basically says all else being equal, the simpler model is better. Right? You don't want to over-parameterize, in other words. You don't want to create this. I mean, you could create, you know, a 100-parameter model that fits the data exactly, and where did you get for yourself? Nowhere, because you can't predict anything with it, because all you could do is predict what you had in the past, right? The better idea is to find something that fits the data reasonably well, explains the process variance, right, and doesn't have any anomalies like the hetero outliers, those kind of things, right? And then I think this is our last criteria, model validation. Another sort of final test would be to systematically remove diagonals from the data and see how well your model that you ended up with would have predicted the diagonals you just removed. Right? If you start finding systematic errors in the way that it's being predicting, then maybe there's something else going on in the model that you need to account for that you didn't realize you had in there. Just give you a couple of two-second slides on what you're going to see tomorrow, and then I think we'll be done here. We can open up for questions. Mac model. He laid out a process for the formula for developing a standard error for the chain letter development estimates. These formulas all assume the error terms, the residuals we just showed you, are normally distributed, and it assumes that they're uniformly proportional across all years. Right? There's no it's homoscedasticity. There's no heteroscedasticity in there. Right? So again, if these are assumptions that are right in the paper, if you're going to use MAC, which is a good model, then you should be looking at this to make sure that it's not in violation of the principles, the assumptions. Bootstrapping. Bootstrapping is a simulated distribution of aggregate reserves based on chain ladder, and it's actually the volume-weighted chain ladder because it's based on a GLM model. When you move away from volume-weighted average, you're actually moving away from the underlying principles of the bootstrap model. It essentially utilizes the standard residuals, same as we were just showing you, right? Essentially uses those in the simulation. What it does is it simulates a sample triangle. It says if these residuals came from the model that's actually fitting, then we can use those residuals to randomly pick from it and actually create other samples of the same triangle that we're trying to figure out from, and then take that using the same process to ultimate and see what the reserve distribution would look like based on a large variety of sample triangles. It's quite interesting. One of the interesting things here is that it doesn't really require an assumption about the residuals. It relaxes the normality assumption. It says the residuals are what the residuals are, and if they're skewed, that shows up in the simulations. It shows up as process variance and parameter uncertainty. It actually changes the mean. When you compare that, the same model to MAC or somewhere else where you've started with the mean, you often find in the bootstrapping, especially if the residuals are skewed a little bit, that the mean of the bootstrap comes out a bit higher because now you've incorporated process uncertainty to the estimate when you didn't really have that in there before. And now for something completely different. This was just really a lead-in for Dave. I wasn't sure if we were doing this all on the same day, but Dave's tomorrow, and we're going to get to see some hands-on stuff. So I think at this point we can throw it open for questions.
Yes.
I have a question for Mark, but before that, a quick comment for Roger. I think one of the reasons that our foreparents, you mentioned foreparents, one of the reasons that foreparents came up with those models, those procedures, those methods, I should say, was also that they didn't have a tremendous amount of technology.
Yeah. Well, ask Ron Bornhuder, he's around. Not here, but.
Ask for the question. One of your points was that is the goal to minimize the range? I'm not sure you can even minimize it, even if you wanted to. The range is a function of the data that you're working with.
Oh, absolutely, I agree. I agree, and that's why I've heard a lot of people say, "Well, the goal is to narrow my range so that I can have a nice confidence in what I'm predicting." That's not the goal at all, I think. The goal is to understand the variability. Understand the process risk that you're facing, right? Thank you. Any other questions?
Yeah, I got one.
Roger.
Go ahead. Yeah.
Go ahead.
How would you compare the relative advantages of validating your model by fitting the model using all the data and then testing it by excluding some diagonals versus fitting the model using some of the data and then testing it using the data that you excluded from the fit?
I think they're very similar but different tests. I mean, the one where you're excluding diagonals, you're basically trying to see if what you knew 3 or 4 years ago was enough to predict what you know now, and if there's a pattern in removing the data, then there's probably something else going on there that may need to be explained, like a calendar year trend or something. The removing the random sample of the data and trying to predict it is more. It's the same sort of goal, but it's trying to do the sort of the entire model at once. It's. I don't know if that helped you or not, but.
Clarification, Mark. Okay. When you talk about the Mac method, to which of his papers are you referring?
Whichever one Dave's using tomorrow.
See, because the one that I that rises the top in my mind starts, you know, has the words distribution free in the title. So I don't know where distribution free and then assuming normality comes in, because actually his paper is distribution free. He comes up with estimates of the standard error without any distributions and doesn't need one for the standard error. But now if you want to start doing distributions of outcomes or distributions of estimates, then you do need some sort of a distribution to assume. Well, that might be where the normality comes from. I don't know.
I think he used normality to simplify all the calculations so they'd work out.
No. Okay. No. There's no.
Well, I defer to Dave then tomorrow. I'll leave that. From the, in the distribution free paper, he doesn't do that.
Yes, in the distribution.
What about the later paper?
I don't know.
Yeah.
Now, he doesn't introduce any distribution. There are a number of critics of Mac who claims that he has got the normal buried in there, but I'm not going to get into that tomorrow, by the way.
Yeah, I know. To tell you the truth, I don't think he does, but there are specific assumptions. The other interesting thing to bear in mind, and that what people often don't catch, is that what he comes up with in that paper is a standard error of the estimates. So if you're looking at what I was talking about, that's the distribution of means. That's not the distribution of outcomes. It's a very important difference. So if you come up with a standard error from the Mac distribution free paper, you're not coming up with the standard deviation of outcomes. You're coming up with a standard deviation of forecasts from chain ladder method under specific assumptions. Okay, Bob, rewind. We got two exposure drafts out there. We got principles and a standards.
Okay.
Which one are you talking about?
The standards.
Okay.
Yeah, one of them.
I understand how we got where we are, but it seems to me that we're not moving where we could be going because people are trying to give everybody enough wiggle room so they can continue doing what they want because of liability issues or whatever.
Okay, let me remove my CAS hat and put on my academy hat. Standards of practice, my understanding are supposed to codify the current level of practice in a particular area. It's not supposed to set a best practices. It's pretty much a safe harbor, almost a minimum practices. So because of that, and because we really haven't transitioned from methods to models yet. You know, face it, take a look at most reports that deal with reserves. You're not going to see models, you're going to see methods. You're going to see chain ladder, you're going to see, you know, Bornhood or Ferguson, you'll see some Berkowitz-Sherman type things. Frequency, severity, basically it. So the standard of practice is supposed to codify basically that. Now, of course, if we've got people from that group, I'd be happy to hear from them. Doesn't look like we do. So yeah, it's kind of a safe harbor. It's not intended to set the goal of where we should be. It's just intended to codify where we are.
Well, it shouldn't inhibit where we want to go.
Oh, of course not. No. No, but it sets a minimum standard. First of all, if you're talking about the ultimate loss ratio being the we're talking point.
You have to agree what you mean by that estimate. I agree.
Okay. Yeah, that's the first thing you lock down. But conceptually, a good model, the models typically are built up in squaring the triangle. I'm not saying all of them, but most of them look at squaring the triangle. So since you can square the triangle, you can effectively check, well, first of all, in a retrospective basis, you can see how your actual for the diagonal comes into your expected. And using a Bayesian approach, you can actually rigorously trim your estimates to take that into account. For a modeling purpose, it's pretty easy. Once you have the model set up, you can effectively assume that you're going to keep the same models, run a simulation with a new diagonal, and then simulate what your final answers would be with those new models, with that new diagonal. You see where I'm going?
Right. But my point is, we don't do that.
Nobody of course.
That. Nobody does that.
Right.
And it might be helpful to manage the expectations or the understanding of the non-actuarial users of these reports.
Yeah, well, part of our problem is our problem and not statistics, and that is the traditional methods effectively forget everything that happened in the past, and effectively say, now this is the right answer, whereas before that wasn't the right answer. And you can get kind of criticized if you try to credibility weight the two. And
right. But if, for example, I estimated 65 this year, and next year, when I do my new estimate based on the emergence of this particular accident year, plus all the other things that have happened to affect the tail, and I come up with 67 now, it might be useful if I can point back to the fact that I had a range, probably a confidence interval, pick a number, that it would be between 61 and 69 with a certain degree of confidence. And then I can point back to say, look,
That's not hard to do if your methods stay mechanical.
Right. If you throw judgment into it, too much judgment, well, maybe any judgment, then it becomes more difficult.
Right? I'm sorry. Is everybody hearing the discussion, even in the back of the room? Okay, good.
Yeah.
The whole point of this session is that you're right, they're not doing it, but they should.
Yeah, I'd like to make one comment. I think the comment in the last session was that you've implicitly predicted the next diagonal, and that instead of just that's built into a chain ladder and other methods and models, and that clearly we've seen emergence in the next diagonal that's been unreasonable, vis-a-vis what's been booked and the prior diagonal. And I think that's a sense of how can you evaluate how well somebody's doing, reserving without having to wait till ultimate. And I think that's an excellent idea.
Right, but effectively simulating the next diagonal to see what your results would look like
right.
Next year might actually have some merit.
But I mean, there's a certain if your next diagonal is bad enough, I mean, there's no way you can go back and say you're
right. But we're looking the other way. We're looking at right now. I'm booking a loss ratio of 65. What could I expect that to look like next year? Is that going to next year? I'm not worrying about at the end of the day, just my next year forecast. How much movement would I expect in that?
Right, my expected value for next year is still 65.
Yes.
But the expected value of my prediction for next year is 65. But that's a mean. But it's going to have a distribution around it. Because if I simulate the loss emergence on this accident year and all the other ones, it's going to change how I look at it the next year. And I should be able to simulate that now, come up with effectively I'm simulating the next diagonal, and then I'm doing next year's analysis. Now.
Right. On a simulated diagonal.
On a simulated basis.
And then you'll get a distribution of what your forecasts are going to look
right.
like next year because you're not going to change anything else.
Right.
Right.
I mean, it sounds like what you're describing, is this right? It sounds like you're talking about instead of a range of reasonableness that is esoteric at best or kind of meaningless at worst, instead it's a kind of a range of reasonableness that now it's got a definition that people can use. You're actually reducing it to a real specific kind of a range of reasonableness. All the different kinds of ranges is actually useful to perhaps the greatest number of potential users because they actually understand what it means instead of just being this amorphous range and who knows what a range really means.
Well, I think there could be some value in it in the sense of it's not at some indeterminate long-term point in the future. By the time you get there, people forgot what you estimated 5 years ago. It's just another way.
Yeah.
Well, that's the other side of the coin.
Why are available? That's easy to do that. They're available now.
Right.
But there are at least two elements. One is the emergence on the actual year you're working on, the policy year or accident year. But then there's an effect on the tail. What happens after one more year of development? Depending on what's happened on other accident years, it may affect your view of how things will go from there.
Right.
Right.
motion?
It's actually worse than that.
We'll take one more.
Title session, who's doing what, so who's actually applying some of this advancement?
Well, I'll throw that to Roger.
Go ahead, Mark.
Well, I know that within Milliman, we're certainly trying to build some of the tools that we described here so that we can use it. I don't know what other people are doing, but we're certainly doing that.
Yeah, unfortunately, people who are really doing this aren't talking too loudly about it. One thing that you could easily do is pick up the working party paper and skim through the bibliography. I'll give you a good sense of who's doing what. And your speaker tomorrow is going to be on there.
One comment on that. I think people are using it more and more, but I think it's a supplement to their core work product, which tends to use the deterministic paid, incurred, BF type methods. And I think people are doing it for somewhat defensive reasons at the moment. But I think that they are slowly doing this maybe on the side. And we would like to see it migrate into the standard work product.
Or running it parallel.
Yeah, that's a good way of phrasing it.
Yeah.
I think we're hitting 5 o'clock, and I want to thank everyone for their patience, and also especially our panelists, Roger and excuse me, and given San Juan, et cetera, and Roger and Mark. So especially Mark did 2 sessions, double duty. So thank you very much.